Good morning. It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, this is what I hope will be a fascinating hour because the topic itself is fascinating and important. Maybe a little bit of a geek alert because, well, one of the things that Chrissy Pease and I share is that we're both geeks. I'm not going to put Rhonda Fanning in that category necessarily. Rhonda, don't be offended. This is a topic that I jumped on when it was proposed. I'm glad we're doing it. Okay, so what is it? The genesis of this discussion is an article that appears in the December issue of Scientific American titled "The Machine That Would Predict the Future." If you dropped all the world's data into a black box, could it become a crystal ball that would let you see the future, even test what would happen if you choose A over B? One researcher thinks so, and he could soon get €1 billion to build it. That's from the article. The writer of the article is David Weinberger. He's my guest this hour, and that article will serve as the starting point for our discussion. But the real point of this hour is to talk about big data and what it means and what is the nature of truth in an era when big data is, that's the latest catchphrase. David Weinberger is senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Laboratory at Harvard Law School. He's the author of Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge, Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. David Weinberger, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, John.
Well, let's start with the machine that would predict the future. What is this machine? What is its purpose, and will it work?
Those are actually harder questions than it seems, because it's a big sprawling project. It's not completely defined, but the idea is that there are many crises in the world in many different sorts of areas, not just geographically, but there are economic crises and there are outbreaks of disease and volcanoes erupt and there's weather and climate. There are all these crises. And we now have far more data available than we ever had before. There has been in the past 10 years a huge increase in the amount of available data, including about things that we just didn't have data for before, like human behavior, what we actually are doing, where we're moving, what we're clicking on, which expresses some sort of interest as well. So we have these crises, we have this new data, we have gigantic computers, we can build supercomputers. Why don't we shove the data into the computers, build models, which is a traditional way over the past 60 or 70 years, so a relatively short tradition, but it's a traditional way of trying to come up with predictions, probabilistic predictions. So we'll build models of how these various domains work, economics, weather, epidemics, everything that might have a bearing. These models contain rules and relationships so that you know if A happens, then B is likely to happen, but obviously a gazillion times more complex. And then we should have, the idea is, we should have a system that we can pose some what-if questions to for policymakers. So what if Greece went off the euro? What ripples might that have all the way through not just the economies of Europe and of the world, but also, say, educational systems, which are obviously affected by economies, and agricultural systems, and so forth? If we can do that, we now have an incredibly powerful simulator that allows us to see the likely outcomes of various policy decisions.
Well, one of the things that's happened, and you pointed this out already, is that we've got this mountain of information. All this data is an overwhelming amount. I mean, we're talking about and it's increasing every day. There are terms for this that have 24 zeros after them, and that's where we'll be in a few years in terms of the amount of data that's stored all over the world. Isn't one of the problems then, not that we don't have enough data, but we have so much that we can't find out what's important, and is that what this machine is trying to get at?
Well, I think that one of the problems with the approach one of the questions to ask about it is sort of the inverse of that, which is to build one of these machines, one of these computers, you have to make decisions about what is important. So you have to, because that's how you build the model. You take factors that you know have a role in how the world works, and you connect them up, and you hope that you've got the relationships right. But that means making, guesses is not the right word, but decisions about which factors are actually going to be important. So one of the questions to ask is, in Tunisia, a sidewalk fruit vendor had had enough of paying bribes to the government, and he set himself on fire. This was a difficult act to predict, and furthermore, the fact that this particular act of protest would set off Arab Spring, is that would have taken a very smart computer to figure out. It's so small events, and events much smaller, actually, than somebody setting himself on fire, which is a pretty dramatic event. But small events in complicated systems and complex systems can have ripple effects that are hugely difficult to predict. And so one of the core problems, I think, is in the very notion of building computer models for complex, highly complex systems, where the interdependencies, the relationships among all the pieces, is so vastly beyond our capacity as humans to think them through. So even identifying sort of the triggers or the butterfly effects is difficult, if not impossible.
But it's an attractive concept. It looks like there's a very good chance that this proposal will get funding, and we're talking about €1 billion here. A lot of money because, if we really could predict the future, it becomes circular argument then, because if you really can predict the future, then that means you can change it, in which case you haven't really predicted it.
Well, one of the complicating questions that the proponents of this fully understand is the role of feedback loops, so that the effects of a model, in this case one that's predicting reaction to policy, and always probabilistically, right? So in every case, the results would not be, we know for certain that this is going to happen coming out of the computer. It would be like a weather forecast, that there's a 70% chance of the euro failing if Greece goes off the euro or whatever. So you can sort of, you can see a path to doing this and getting good enough results or results that might be helpful. And as the proponent, chief proponent of this says, if you even had more of an inkling about the financial meltdown that happened a couple of years ago, the billion euro cost would be fully justified. It's a big if, but that's the hope and the claim.
We're talking we're talking about big data, and I want to get to that because the machine that would predict the future is just one little piece of this. When you think about what we believe we know today, and you compare it to what humankind thought they knew, say in 1400 in Europe, just to pick a spot, and you compare those two things, it's obviously we at least think we know a lot more. What do we really know, and how do we manage that, and what is the nature of truth and all of those things? We'll be talking about that during the hour. Before I forget, I want to give the phone number and other ways for people to make contact and ask questions. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. You can reach us via email, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And there's also a Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can leave a comment there, and we'll share it with people on the radio. It's really kind of interesting, the progression here. You and I, David Weinberg, are talking about this topic on the radio, which is a a pretty old medium by comparison. I just gave a toll-free phone number, which is sort of part of the analog world. Email now sort of seems out of date, and then we have this Facebook thing, which I'm not even sure how current that is anymore, but this is sort of a microcosm of sort of where we've come even in the last 85 or 90 years.
Yes, and I think one of the biggest changes that this points to is that the systems, the media that we had for storing and communicating knowledge in the 1400s all the way up through very recently, were good at doing that. They had a lot of limitations, but they could, you could store and communicate pretty well knowledge, but it didn't have what the current medium has, the Internet, which is the Internet is simultaneously a medium for information and knowledge and for communication and for being social. And when you have the same medium doing all of those things and no real way of separating those activities, then knowledge and knowledge really begins to look like a different thing. It's one thing when knowledge is a content that's locked in a book, a medium that preserves and communicates. It's another when the medium for preserving and communicating is the very same one that you use for talking with other people and building up social relationships and forming these social networks and webs. And knowledge just doesn't stay as content in a book anymore, for better and for worse. I think there's a lot of mainly wonderful things that happen here, but there's also a bunch of dangers and concerns, of course.
Well, and I want to get to those, but let's take a look at this from the standpoint of that change. Now, if I'm reading a book, let's say that, recently I just finished rereading Raphael Sabatini's Scaramouche, which I think somebody ought to make into a motion picture again. But I just finished reading that. Well, I have no opportunity to interact with Raphael Sabatini. He's dead. I don't happen to believe in mediums, so, I don't have any way to interact with that person. But the authors who are writing today, they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook. You can actually ask them questions. You can say, okay, Stephen R. Donaldson, you're writing the third cycle of your original Thomas Covenant trilogy. What the heck were you thinking? You can actually have those interactions now, whereas you couldn't. You couldn't in the old technological model.
And the author of Scaramouche may be dead, but the readers of Scaramouche are very much alive, and at least a handful of them, including you. And if you look around on the web, you'll find bunches of people who are talking about it. I just did a search at librarything.com. Goodreads is another such site where people who like books and like to talk about books and share ideas about books come together and they talk about what they're reading. If you look at this in terms of nonfiction, where there are experts, let's say an expert who's alive, just to since you might as well, the discussion about the work of knowledge, whether it's a scientific paper or nonfiction book, a history or whatever, that discussion takes that work and embeds it in a social context. Webs grow up around it. We can see how the ideas in those works are traveling through the culture in a way that we could never see before. You can't see what the people who are reading, you couldn't see what the people who are reading a work were thinking about it, how they were appropriating it or misappropriating it, how they're getting it right or wrong or adding to it, but now you can. And those, because that's public, because it's in a medium that is connected and public, you not only see what people are thinking and how they're reacting, you're seeing them in conversation with others. And that web of ideas, of kicking around the ideas in, say, a nonfiction work, scientific article, has, I believe, this is my hypothesis anyway, has more value than the work itself. That web adds explanations, it applies those ideas in new directions the author would never have thought of, it gets some things wrong, and we hope that other people leap in and help to get it right. Knowledge seems to me to be moving into these webs and networks, and breaking free of the old medium of print, of books that have covers.
Mm. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. My guest this hour is David Weinberger, senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Laboratory at Harvard Law School. He's the author of the book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts. Experts are everywhere, and the smartest person in the room is the room. That's a book that's coming out soon. And we're talking about big data and what it means and how the nature of knowledge has changed because of technology and what that might mean for us going forward. We kind of got our start with an article in Scientific American about the machine that would predict the future, but we are moving on from that. Inviting you to ask questions and make comments and pose ideas at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. You can also leave a comment at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we will pass it along. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're talking about the nature of knowledge in an era of rapidly changing technology, how much information is out there, the concept of big data or big data. David Weinberger is my guest, senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Laboratory at Harvard Law School. He has a book coming out very soon, titled Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. We have full phone lines. So let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's start in Madison. Frank, you'll be first. Frank, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. This is quite interesting. It does bring to mind the Python's deep thought. And there's some problem in transferring authority to a machine that isn't basing, it doesn't share the assumptions of its clients. But I think there's a second point. There's a problem with the amount of data that we are able to accumulate, but even given massive computing power, process meaningfully. The molecular biology and genetics community can accumulate sequence data much more quickly than it can actually process it and in meaningful ways understand it. So there's a question of the difference between information and knowledge. And then finally, we can have the computing power to make realistic short-term models, but projecting into the future is obviously problematic, and answers, if they are available, can be built into the initial assumptions of the analysis. And finally, many, many years ago, a friend and I used to break into, I won't specify which medical school's computers, to get at the computing power so that we could do curve fittings. And when we had finished with our work, the computers had been made available to medical students because they had digital patients. And we would kill off a few patients before we logged off. And this caused a certain consternation amongst the instructional staff. So thank you very much.
Well, Frank, those are wonderful and deep questions. I'm going to go through them as quickly as I can without doing them justice, of course. So, first, one of the people I talked with about when researching the article is Victoria Stodden, who made a very similar point to your first one. And she pointed out that if a policy advisor a maker were to go to this computer and ask for advice, the most valuable advice it can give is the stuff that's counterintuitive, because the stuff that is intuitive, we don't need it for. It's really the counterintuitive. And so if the machine were to say, for example, the answer to your economic or ecological problem or whatever is set fire to all your oil wells, something so deeply counterintuitive, the policymaker couldn't possibly ever get that adopted on the basis of a machine's recommendation. So there are issues around how radically such a machine would be able to advise us. Second of all, information knowledge, I would add understanding to that, a term you also used. There's a field, a relatively new field, about 10, 15 years old, called systems biology, which looks at biological systems as complex systems. So even just knowing what's going on in the cell, you know, the most basic unit of life, is so complex. But we're getting pretty good. We've fed in lots of data about what happens if this chemical touches the cell and that one does and so forth. But it's so complex that the human brain simply cannot understand it. Yet we know now far better what's going on with cells as complex systems. And so we're in this odd position of having knowledge but not understanding. We know what's going on, but our brains simply cannot understand all of those interactions. And increasingly that's going to be the case. And we're smarter for it. It's sort of a weird thing. And then finally, briefly about the starting conditions of these systems. Yes, these systems are very, very sensitive to the rules that we build them on. You get some of those wrong, and you could be vastly off. And very sensitive also to the starting conditions that you feed in, as, you know, here's how the world is now. And another person that I spoke with when doing the article is a weather researcher who says, points out that we've gotten much better at modeling the complex system that is weather, so that weather forecasts over the short term, 3, 4, 5 days, are way more accurate than they were just 10 or 20 years ago. But, this person says, there seems to be a theoretical limit for predicting the weather, and it's around 15 days, that no matter how good we get, the system's just too complex. We won't be able to predict beyond 15 days. Now, to be clear, this is for weather, not for climate, a very different thing. And so there does seem to be some limits on how far out we can look when the systems get really, really complex.
Frank, thanks for that question. Let's go to Jason in Sparta next. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Howdy, howdy. Well, I just don't understand how a computer can predict the future, as the human brain changes thought process and what it's going to do. I can't punch into a computer how far down the road. I'm going to drive coast to coast. I can't punch in a computer. I'm going to drive 3,000 miles. Am I going to get into an accident? A computer can't tell me that. Somebody else is driving down the roads towards me. They're going to change their mind because they're hungry, so they decide to get off the road. Well, that's when the computer tells me I was supposed to get into an accident. The human brain changes thought process too many times, and a computer is not a human brain. It just can't tell us what's going to happen. I don't see how this is going to work, no matter how much money they stick into this, as it's just not a human brain. There's too many human factors for anything to be punched into a computer to have it tell us what's going to happen. Am I right or am I wrong? If I'm wrong, well, that's the human factor. So I guess that's my thought process on why dump a lot of money into something that a computer is just not a human brain.
So one of the things that has scientists most excited, and that's explains some of the enthusiasm for this project, I think everybody agrees that predicting what's going to happen to you or what you're going to do tomorrow or the next instant is, you know, virtually impossible. But over the past 10 years, with the availability of these vast amounts of data about what humans actually do, whether it's data about how we drive, you know, what our traffic patterns are, or our geolocation thanks to the ubiquitous cell phones, all the information gathered on the web and so forth. There is so much more data available than ever before that researchers are discovering that taken as a mass, humans actually are far more predictable than many of us are comfortable believing. Not what you're going to do tomorrow or what you're going to pick off the menu or whatever, but you model the behavior of thousands or millions of people, and some patterns actually start to emerge that we would otherwise never have thought of. This is a very young field. There's been considerable progress, and many of the people who support this project, in fact, are supporting, at least some of them, some that I talked with, are supporting not so much the building of a giant computer as here's a field in which we could put €1 billion to pretty good use, investigating what we can learn about humans based upon this aggregate mass of data that we now have.
Jason, thanks for the call. I'd like to kind of bend the discussion toward some of the research that shows up in your book, Too Big to Know. For example, one of the things that you say is that knowledge is now lateral and associational rather than hierarchical and structured. And I know you touched on this a little bit when you talked about the difference between knowledge in books and knowledge that's in what is essentially almost a living organism we call the Internet. But talk about those terms and what they mean.
So knowledge is an ancient term in the West. It's got about 2,500 years of history behind it. And it's actually getting a little hard to remember what it was just a generation ago, where knowledge in this 2,500-year history was the very human attempt, the special human destiny. It's something only humans can do, animals can't. This was our thinking in the West anyway. And the aim of knowledge was to discover the order of the universe, because to see everything we assumed had its place. It had an essence and a place. It was related to everything else. And it was God's order. It's how God set up the world. And so the human task was to discover where everything goes. And so Darwin, for example, spent 7 years before he got around to publishing his, the evolutionary book. He spent 7 years dissecting barnacles to discover whether they're mollusks or crustaceans. It was important to know because that's what knowledge was. Is a thing this or is it a that? So the Internet enters. So at that point, knowledge is very clearly filtered. It's authorized by competent and credentialed people. Disputes are resolved. Things are written down in the big book of knowledge, and we make progress that way. On the net, it turns out there's trying to decide whether a thing is a this or a that turns out not to be nearly as interesting as we used to think it was. It was interesting when you had to make a decision and write it down, and you had to decide how to order the physical things, order the physical books in your library, where everything has to go in one spot and only one spot. But on the net, it's not that type of hierarchical order. It's links, and anybody can put in a link, and the links can be multiple, and they can be inconsistent. One person could link barnacles to mollusks, and somebody else to crustaceans, and somebody else to something else. Things gain meaning on the web by being connected to lots and lots and lots and lots of things, not placed in a nice, careful, top-down order. And I think that we are beginning in many fields to treat knowledge that way as well, that we understand something better if we see it in a rich, messy, even contradictory web of ideas and classifications and arguments and disputes. Knowledge has gotten much, much messier than it ever was before.
Is this a good or a bad thing, or doesn't it really, is that not the right question?
Well, it's an inevitable question. I mean, of course we want to know that, but I don't think we can know it too well. I mean, we can see some things that look good from the old point of view or look bad from the old point of view. But we're in a period of transition. It's very hard to know. But I will say this, that if you are in a field that deals with knowledge, I mean, that's your profession, whether you're an educator or you're a scientist, or this is the greatest time in human history to be alive. If you're curious or you care about knowing and understanding things, there's never been such a wonderful time, and we're just at the beginning of it.
Well, you know, I was struck as I was reading about this topic and preparing for it, some of the parallels in terms of how we look at things. Marshall McLuhan said we live life in the rearview mirror. We're always looking back. The medium is the message or the massage. How we are trying to frame the discussion about knowledge in the age of big data in terms of the previous technology, and that's sort of an artificial limitation on the discussion.
Very much so. I think McLuhan was right about that, as he was about many other things as well. But we have no choice but to understand new things in terms of the old. So when the web appeared, many businesses and news media in particular viewed it as a publishing medium. That's how they think about things. So of course it looked like a publishing medium to them. And it is a publishing medium, but it's not just a publishing medium, and it's a much bigger change than simply digital. It's like publishing but without the paper. Well, actually it does that, but that's just the beginning of it. And we are only now 15 years into the World Wide Web. We are only, I think, at the beginning of understanding what it is, developing a new understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll take a call from Jeff in Madison. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling to relate an experience I have with your guest, who is an old friend, and I say woof to him.
Hello, Jeff.
Hi. As listening to the discussion, I was brought back to an experience I had with your guest, David, back, I believe it was in the 90s, when he was working at a high-tech, for the lack of a better word, publishing company. And he was showing me this concept that the company used, which was called a hyperlink. And he was extremely excited about it. And for the life of me, I didn't get it. Hearing David talk about the difference between vertical and horizontal organization and so on, took me back to those days. And I think back as a, I'd like to think of myself as reasonably intelligent and well educated, but my inability to understand the concept of what a hyperlink was back then, and David, your comments about viewing this the initial take on the internet as a way to publish in electronic form, it just brings to mind how I think often difficult it is for those of us who are not immersed in that world to really understand the significance of these changes.
Hi, Jeff, it's been too long. Hyperlinks are they seem, it's the same sort of thing that John was saying, that when you first see a hyperlink, you inevitably think about it in terms of the prior technology. And so a hyperlink looks like an automatic footnote. You know, one thinks about it inevitably as a way of going between two books, something that was difficult to do. You had to get up and go to the library and get the next book. And of course, hyperlinks do that. But behind hyperlinks is a whole power structure. One of the things that the web got right that the high-tech company that I was at did not get right is Hyperlinks can be put in by anybody. The web is the creation, a mass creation by a significant portion of humanity at this point, rather than having to go through any type of filtering process or get approved ahead of time or sort of recompile the system and redistribute it every time a new link goes in. It's so easy for people to do that it's taken a power structure that was based around the difficulty of publishing and connecting ideas, and it dispersed that power structure. So that now the fact that anybody can create a hyperlink has sort of destructures not only old media, like books and newspapers and so forth, it destructures a culture. We're also used to the idea now that not only can we express something, we can say something, which was difficult to do in public before, but we can connect it with something else, and that this is an additive process, that what we end up with is bigger than the aggregate of individual comments. We end up with a web that's linked, where every link expresses some human interest, which is why the internet as a medium, if you think about it as a medium, which is, of course, the old metaphor, it's a medium in which, rather than the content expressing the interests of the owners of the medium, it's a direct expression of what humans are actually interested in. We've never had that before.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Glad we could provide a radio reunion here. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back. And we don't have anywhere near enough time to even begin to scratch the surface of this topic, which is one of the limitations of this particular medium. Although we have an hour, whereas a television news story would maybe be 45 seconds. But we'll try and do our best in the time remaining to us here. As I said, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We have more phone calls. I have about 6 pages of questions. I'll have to go and do some triage and see which ones are the most important. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:44. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Today, in this hour, we're talking about knowledge and how it's changing because the way we transmit knowledge and collect knowledge and collate knowledge and sort knowledge, all of those things are being driven by new technology, and it's changing the way we need to look at all this stuff. We're trying to get a handle on the moment. I think David Weinberger is my guest. He's senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Also co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Laboratory at Harvard Law School. He has a book coming out titled Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts. Experts are everywhere, and the smartest person in the room is the room. And David Weinberger, before we go back to the phones, I just want to ask, when is this book coming out?
January 3rd, but Amazon announced it's actually shipping today.
Okay. And then I would be remiss in my hostly duties if I didn't ask you about this title, and this could be an entire show here, but one of the things that you discuss, and that has been a discussion, is, let's take the easy one. Experts are everywhere. Anybody can be an expert. You used to have to look at the newspaper to get a review of a movie or go to a magazine about motion pictures to get a review of a movie. Now, anybody who goes to the multiplex can go home, get online, and write their own review. We're all critics. And that's just one example.
And there's good and bad on that, and we now have complex and generally pretty useful systems for filtering through the amazing amount of information and opinion that there is out there.
Well, that's the easy one. But what about the facts aren't the facts? What do you mean by that?
Well, the famous Senator Moynihan quote that everybody's entitled to his own opinion but not his own facts has been growing in popularity, and I think because it gives us a sense of comfort that we all just get together and agree, face the facts, we'll come up and with something we all agree on, which is a very comforting idea. But I think the real lesson of the web is that if you're on it for even for a couple of days, you realize that we are never going to agree about anything. I mean, some people are wrong. I'm not saying everything is true, but just as a matter of fact, we are not ever really going to agree on everything, on anything. And so Moynihan's comfort is not really going to materialize for us. We have to deal with that.
The smartest person in the room is the room?
Yeah, that's just intended to be a semi-clever way of saying that a web of experts, a web of people who know something and care about something, under the right circumstances, is smarter than the sum of the smartness of the individuals. Webs can be smarter than individuals are.
Well, we know that individual humans can be smart, but mobs are generally stupid. So it's another way to look at it. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll go to Greenfield now and hear what Mike has to say. Mike, go ahead.
Good morning. After Steve Jobs died, I realized I was living in California in the Silicon Valley during the genesis of Apple, and actually went to the same junior college as him. But I'm not here to talk about the beginning of the web, but I want to distinguish knowledge from wisdom, and I think the philosophy of knowledge is 3 miles wide and an inch deep, and I think we need to clarify the difference between knowledge and wisdom, because you can have a bunch of statistics and data and be an imbecile, and wisdom is something that you gain from non-technical things.
There's no reason to think that you put enough knowledge together and you get wisdom, so I agree. We have a term for people who know a great deal but don't have a lot of wisdom, which is know-it-alls, and we tend not to like them. So, Mike, I agree with you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's go to Menominee Falls next and talk to Bob. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, my question is that I was thinking about your example of the Arab Spring and how it was triggered by this unfortunate man who killed himself. And wouldn't it have been plausible to look at the groundswell of public sentiment and to see that something was going to happen and that eventually something else would have triggered this? I look at global warming, and everybody seems to actually be enjoying it. We don't have to shovel our sidewalks. But if a major Arctic ice shelf were to break off and the ocean levels were to go up, or perhaps a gigantic melt of methane under the ocean floor were to happen, public sentiment would turn around massively.
It's certainly the case that the aim of those who propose the sort of computer that's aiming for the billion-euro grant, and additionally for people who are interested in studying what we can learn about human behavior based upon the enormous amounts of data that we have, would say something very similar to what you've said about Arab Spring, that you may not know what the trigger is going to be, but we can begin to see indicators that it's ripe for some trigger causing it. And so that's genuine value, and that's something that, with the rise of big data, it seems like we can get better at economic forecasting as well. At least two caveats. One is that the trigger events may have, in complex systems, may have a bigger effect and change the course of the movement than we thought. So it may turn out to have made a difference whether it was somebody in Tunisia or somebody in Egypt, and whether it was a street vendor or a politician or whatever. So those changes in initial conditions can be, or of trigger events, can be actually quite significant. But this is the hope that we can see trends and thus at least be somewhat prepared for the events that become increasingly probable.
Bob, thanks for the call. Saul in Stevens Point, you'll be next. Saul, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi. This is another example of rampant positivism. Big systems, complex systems, like the quants learned during the financial upheaval, is very unstable. It is not a stable system. And so predicting an unstable system, that a system will be unstable, okay. But in terms of actually predicting results that can be useful, this is like putting the million monkeys in a room with a bunch of typewriters, and eventually they'll come up with Shakespeare. Who is it that determines that this is of the quality of Shakespeare. I mean, there has to be some intervening intelligence that makes us, that wants to make sense of a particular pattern in big data. But in terms of predictability, it's an unstable system. I don't understand it.
Well, it's a complex system, and so I think that one of the alternatives to taking this big data and trying to model it by figuring out what the rules are and how things interact, which in a complex system is surpassing our ability, it seems to me, at least at this point, and maybe theoretically. So one of the alternatives to that is the science commons approach, which says, which is equally excited about the amount of big data that's available. So you take this big data, you make more and more of it available, you do it in particular formats that are friendly to computer use and to aggregation and to sorting and that sort of thing. But rather than feeding it into a single model or set of models, you instead get a community of scientists around the world who work on this in all the different ways that scientists want to. And some are going to build models, and some are going to build models that are crazy, and some are just are going to build ones that are amazingly insightful and as good as they can be, all limited, of course. And then, as John Wilbanks, who's was at Science Commons, put it, and I really like this phrase, what's important, he says, is that your nerds argue with my nerds. That is that rather than viewing this as a complex machine that's going to make predictions, view it more like a marketplace in which people are engaging in never-ending argument, discussion, agreement, the way that scientists do when you put them into a room, when you connect them. And now we have them connected because we have this amazingly connective new medium. That will not come up with a machine. You can ask a question and get an answer, but at least according to this line of thinking, is more likely to deal with the instability of large, complex systems.
Saul, thanks. Thanks for your question. Let's go quickly to Gene in Oshkosh. And Gene, we're getting short on time. Go ahead.
Yes, certainly. Happy New Year to John and David. Something's been bothering me a long, long time. Ever since. Ever since about the Korean War period, when I was drafted, and since I had degrees in philosophy, I was assigned to the Atomic Energy Commission. My question really is there a does computer science have as its major enemy or one of its enemies the atomic energy, atomic energy itself? It just has seemed to me that the atomic energy is a, you know, bombs, radiation is a an enemy to massing data, and could destroy the data. Would you comment on that?
Let's get David's comment if you want to, and then I've got one call I really want to get to before the end of the program. Oh, we just lost him. Go ahead.
Gene, it's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about it, and I don't know. So thank you for the question.
Well, thank you.
Gene, thanks for the call. We had another caller who couldn't hang on but wanted to get a discussion going about the nature of truth. Now we have about a minute and a half to do that. That's a whole program. But are we? Is the nature of what we consider to be truth, is that, are we changing it? Have we decided that it's situational and the truth is just what we all agree on? Is the concept of objective truth outmoded?
Yeah, to a certain degree, I think objectivity is. But I think the comforting way of putting this is I think that we are coming closer to science's view of truth, which is not that it's subjective, but that it's always probabilistic, it's evidential. You gather evidence, you make the best hypotheses you can, you support them as best you can. But the notion that we are, as a culture, going to gather the right facts, piece them together like a giant jigsaw puzzle, and build a picture of truth that corresponds to reality, the way that Western philosophy has conceived of it, I think in practical terms, we've pretty much given up on that.
But the scientific approach to truth is actually not a bad model to go with.
So, big data changing everything. We're trying to understand the current situation in light of what our history and what our culture has taught us growing up. The next generation is going to be looking at this from a completely different set of lenses. What does that all mean for the future? I mean, we've got all this data. Okay, fine, but what do we do with it? And why does it matter?
Well, because we can learn so much from it. We're opening up areas of investigation we didn't think were possible before. So that's really important. The biggest danger I see is that we will only talk with people with whom we already agree and simply confirm what we already know. The hope is that we are already doing much more than that and engaging in the sort of linked, connected conversations where we accept that there's never going to be final agreement, but are doing our best to work our way through a world that is so complex and so big that we can never know it finally.
And we'll leave it there. Thank you very, very much, David Weinberger, for being my guest.
Oh, thank you, John.
David Weinberger, senior researcher at Harvard University's Berkman Center. Chrissy Pease produced this hour of programming. Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.